Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin, and today I'm speaking to Lindsay Stonebridge, a professor of humanities and human rights at the University of Birmingham. Her work focuses on 20th century contemporary literature, theory, and history. A prolific author as well as an academic, she's earned a number of accolades for her writing, including the British Academy Rose Crawshaw Award and the Modernist Studies Association Best Book Prize. Her latest work is Writing and Writing, Literature in the Age of Human Rights. Lindsay, welcome to Monocle Reads. Tell me about the spark for this book.
Well, it had two sparks. One was the classroom, as it often is for people who write and teach. And I was teaching a course on the history of human rights, which we were teaching through literature. So it was a really ambitious course, which I taught with a colleague who's a specialist in 18th century history, that went from the 18th century and the rights of man up to the present day. And rather than teaching history or philosophy, we were introducing students to some key ideas in the history of rights through the reading of novels and poems and plays, etc. And it was a fabulous course to teach. The students were brilliant. It was very, very exciting. And this was in the 2010s. And exactly as we were teaching the course, things began to go very wrong for human rights. We were dealing with the fallout of the Iraq War, where the idea of Western human rights had come under quite a bit of criticism. Also in the 2010s, you started to get direct attacks on human rights, whether it was through new nationalist states or indeed closer to home. The 2014 election was largely fought on a question of whether we would keep the 1998 Human Rights Act here in the UK. And then you had the war in Syria and the civil war in Libya, and you had the refugee crisis. And suddenly human rights, the question of how we were treating other people, the question of rights exploded into the world. So there's this very strange experience of teaching the history of literature and human rights whilst watching human rights undergo very tumultuous and threatened part of its history. So the book is actually a collection of teaching notes and pieces of journalism and essays that I put together in that period to try and respond to that sense of here was this wonderful history of imagination and human rights, which was disappearing in front of our eyes, it seemed, at that point.
Mm. I mean, the book demonstrates the value of bold literature in testing times. Do you think that we're now seeing a wave of authors and writers that really can make a difference?
I think we are. You know, Georgina, I'm getting quite excited about the kinds of writing that are coming into our world now. I mean, as someone who teaches literature and history, I get very frustrated with the idea that, you know, literature is just for solace or for escapism or a nice to have in a very bad world. And, you know, those of us who spend a lot of time reading and teaching and writing really want, you know, people to know that literature is transformative. It sets new norms. It can set new norms for the ways in which we treat each other. It's very, very powerful stuff. There's a quote by Hannah Arendt, the political theorist, who's one of my favorite thinkers, where she says at some point, you know, there are no dangerous ideas. Thinking itself is dangerous. And I often think that about writing. I think there's no one dangerous book. Writing itself is very, very dangerous. So yes, I do think we might be entering into a new age of the kind of writing that can help us learn how to live with one another.
You say in the book that literature carves out a space in the world from which we might begin to grasp injustice from the inside, from the position of the powerless. How important can literature be as a voice for people who may often have been silenced? And do you think it can also encourage empathy from decision makers in a more effective way than just perhaps a kind of dry report?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's always been a tradition of, you know, we tell history usually from the perspective of the victors, the people who won. When people talk about human rights policy, it's often people who are in charge of big NGOs or governmental agencies. But every significant kind of human rights movement or the kind of changing of consciousness has come from the ground up. And if you want to understand how human rights violations happen, you don't kind of look to often the people who are making those violations happen. You look to the people who are suffering that violation. And I think this is so important because it's not just a question of the powerful giving rights on the basis of sympathizing or feeling pity for poor people. I think the best writers actually analyze the terms of abuse. So the example I would give, when Hannah Arendt wrote Origins of Totalitarianism, don't forget, she was a refugee. She was a stateless person. She was a Jewish woman. She knew a lot about how totalitarianism worked, and she was describing it from the inside. A more contemporary example, the absolutely extraordinary writer Behrouz Bouchani, who was imprisoned on Manus Island as part of their migration regime. His book, No Friend from the Mountain, not only is it an extraordinary written book, I mean, the writing is so palpably powerful. He gives us a sense of the kind of inhuman degradation that is the new norm in refugee and migrant regimes from the inside. And it's a book of analysis, it's a book of political theory. He's saying, I'm going to show you how this works from the inside. So it is, yes, a question of empathy, but I think it's actually a question of, I was quite suspicious of empathy because it's something that the powerful tend to give to the powerless. Mm. What we really need to read literature for is to teach us how this is working. I mean, forms of injustice don't often look to a lot of people like forms of injustice. They look like background noise, or they look like reasonable ways to behave. They're not. And the people who know they're not are the people who suffer from within those systems.
I thought it was really interesting how you pick up on the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights and talk about how it was heavily influenced by Robinson Crusoe. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, well, this is not my work. This is the work of the amazing human rights scholar Joseph Slaughter, who went into the archives. He was looking at how the drafters of the 1948 convention came to agree on what human rights are. I mean, this is an extraordinary moment, right? This is the beginning of the Cold War, the end of the Second World War. Lots of people have very different ideological stakes in the drafting of this document. And they get to Article 29, and they kind of, half of the drafters want to say, you have duties to your community, to your society, as well as rights. And that tended to be from Soviet Union, from socialist countries. And the liberal Western tradition wanted to say, no, we have to defend individual personal rights at all times. And quite often they clashed on this. But they didn't want to go to ideological war, because they were supposed to be drafting this great document that would define human rights for everyone. So they started, instead of discussing these big, bold ideas, they actually spoke for 2 weeks about Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, which is the kind of, origin story about what we owe to others, what we owe to the wreckage that we find ourselves in, and what part does the kind of self-made man, the author of his and producer of his own domain and property play. It is also, of course, a slave narrative. So they actually sat there, it was like, as Joseph Slaughter says, it was like a literary seminar for 2 weeks as they battled over a literary text. Now, as a literature professor, I think, yeah, great. But I also think, and I mean this quite seriously, wouldn't it be better if some of our policymakers, some of our institutional agencies concerned with rights, spent more time battling over these ideas with a book, with a piece of writing? I also make the point that, with Behrouz Bouchani's book, a human rights lawyer called Itamar Mann sent the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court a copy of the book and said, can we talk about this, please? Rather than, so what would happen if we went back to the vision of the 1948 drafters and said, yeah, we're going to sit here and we're going to talk about these really difficult, really strange and difficult ideas, but we're going to do it with literature.
Yeah. Now, Virginia Woolf is another great example of this, and the book Three Guineas, which yeah, obviously looks at fascism and that being the creation of man. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yes, I mean, Virginia Woolf is a sort of touch point, I think, for me for a lot of these things. And I hadn't read Three Guineas for an awful long time. And in Three Guineas, it was just a very unpopular book. I think, one of her subtitles for it was something like on being really unpopular, because it was a moment just before World War II where a lot of her friends had fought in Spain. A lot of people were saying that, we're going to have to fight fascism with violence because it's a violent ideology. And in the end, that turned out to be right. Woolf took a radical pacifist position, but what she would not do is sign up to very spongy pacifist ideas that tried to dampen down other inequalities, principally around gender, around race and colonialism and capitalism. She said, you can't come here and start preaching to me about world peace and the kinds of interventions you're going to make in that unless you acknowledge the violence that's done to women and the violence that's done through the capitalist arms market, the violence that has been done in our names before. And that's where she comes up with that great statement, as a woman, I have no country. As a woman, my country is the whole world. And when I went back to that text, I thought, actually, this is much more radical than we think. She's not just saying no war. which might have been the kind of wrong thing she said at that time. What she's saying is, like, you can't go and preach peace and humanitarian values and anti-war unless you realise your complicity with making those things happen. And she is relentless on that. It's a really, really cutting piece of work. So it's extraordinary to go back to that text in the light of recent developments.
Absolutely. So to conclude, I mean, once again, you quote Arendt, and who are you is a really central question then in this type of literature.
Yeah. Who are you? Yes, Arendt always says, you know, we need, in order to have human rights, Arendt didn't think we could just have human rights by being human, because that clearly doesn't work. Otherwise, we wouldn't have children in cages and people languishing in the mud of Calais. What she says, rights are always done communally. We decide collectively what it means to give each other the right to have rights, which is why things like free speech, political rights and civil rights are so, so important, why you can't just lock people out. And that happens in a community where the question is like, well, who are you, is absolutely central. And I was reminded very much of Arendt's thinking about that through the poetry of a friend of mine, Yusuf Mohamed Kasime, who is here now, but was born in Badawi refugee camp, a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon. And that camp has been hosting a lot of refugees from Syria over the last 10 years. I mean, do remember that, you know, the so-called refugee crisis landed on the doorsteps of Lebanon, Jordan and Turkey, not so much Germany, the UK and France. And he writes this beautiful poem which talks about refugees coming into what was already a refugee camp and asking the question, so who are you to come to us? Who are we to come to you? Who are we to host you? And those questions of human entanglement, of otherness, are at the heart, I think, both of literature. The mysteries of otherness are always at the heart of literature, but also at the heart of human rights.
Lindsay, thank you so much. So interesting.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Writing and Writing, Literature in the Age of Human Rights by Lindsay Stonebridge is published by Oxford University Press. And you've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull, Steph Chungu and Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.